Steve Gorham with us. We're talking about how the climate is just doing what it does. We're going to take your calls this hour when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you along with Steve Gorham. His website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His books include Outside the Green Box, The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climatism. Well, I remember that old movie, The Mad, Mad, Mad World. Remember that one, Steve?
Yeah, I do.
One of those classic comedies. It was one of the best. So where do we head as a nation, as a world, if nothing changes, if people still continue to fight back and forth about this and nothing gets done?
Well, I think the climatists, if you will, the people that want to fight global warming, have the upper hand, and they're going to put forward these policies. President Biden has called for 100% renewable electricity by 2035. Many states have adopted 100% electricity. There's a thing going around called net zero emissions by 2050, which is kind of foolish. We can talk about that. But so these policies are going to be implemented, and a big drive is electric vehicles, of course. These policies are going to attempt to be implemented. They have been implemented in parts of Europe to some extent. And unfortunately, consumers are going to get the brunt of this. These are going to cause, first, electricity prices to go up. Second, it's going to cause a huge amount of land. A study done by Net Zero, called titled Net Zero America, done by Princeton University last year, found that if we're going to do this this wind and solar by 2050, you'd need an area that was bigger than 228,000 square miles, an area larger than Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Wisconsin.
Jeez.
Six states, just massive amounts of land. The third thing that's going to occur is that we're going to have electricity blackouts. We're going to have a degradation, and we're already seeing it in our electricity supply.
I'm also concerned about our power grid in case something happens with a solar flare or EMP attack.
Yep. Yeah, and you know what? One of the things we're doing is everybody says, well, get rid of coal and get rid of nuclear. But those are the things that run all the time. We had lethal blackouts last February in Texas. 130 people or so died. And there were a couple of factors. One was the wind turbines froze up. Second is you had a storm and you couldn't get any solar. But we also had an interruption in the natural gas supply that couldn't get to the power plants.
Right.
Natural gas is hard to store. They can store it, in reservoirs and other things. But those forms of electricity are not as reliable in times of stress as nuclear or coal. You have nuclear and coal. They just make big piles of coal on the site, and you've got it there. You can burn it whenever you need it, and nuclear has all the fuel. So we have, by putting a damper on the nuclear and retiring plants and getting rid of the coal plants, in addition to renewable intermittency, we're making our grid much less reliable, and this is going to be a big issue. When you got over 100 people dying because of a snowstorm and a blackout, that's a serious issue.
Absolutely. Let's take some calls here for you, Stephen. They're lining up. Let's go to west of the Rockies, Steve in Casa Grande, Arizona. Hey, Steven.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, my friend. How are you?
Pretty good. Are you going to need Elvis up there when you're up there in Seattle next week?
I'm going to play the part of Elvis.
Oh, you're going to do it, huh?
Yes, sir. But go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask the gentleman about, isn't it true that, like, one volcano, all the pollution from one volcano equals all the emissions from all the vehicles in the world? That was something I had read. I think we're losing our minds trying to switch to all solar. And I agree with what he's saying, that we're going to kill ourselves financially by trying to switch to the renewables too fast.
Well, then what happens, Steve, if a different administration comes in 4 years, 8 years, and changes everything again?
Yeah, that's the thing about our system. So, Steve, good question. The answer is probably that in most cases, volcanoes are not a big part of things. There are exceptions, though. Occasionally, we have a massive eruption. There was one in...
when they go, that's
15,
for sure.
The 16th century, they had Krakatoa in 1880. When they get very, very big, they can reduce world temperatures for a couple of years. Pinatubo, I think, was a recent one. But typically, actually, a bigger factor in the natural part of the greenhouse effect is the carbon dioxide that comes naturally out of oceans. There's 50 times as much carbon dioxide dissolved in the oceans as is in the atmosphere, and the oceans are always releasing carbon dioxide and absorbing it. You have plants that die and release carbon dioxide, and when plants grow, they absorb it. And then, as you're right, you do have a smaller factor as volcanoes, both above the surface of the ocean and under the surface of the ocean, about 10 times as many as that are above the surface that are putting gases like CO2 into the atmosphere, into the environment, into the ocean, naturally all the time. And the thing that people don't realize is those natural emissions of carbon dioxide are much, much bigger than from industry. Every day, 20 times as much carbon dioxide comes from nature as from our industries. And so if you break down the greenhouse effect, you find that the industrial portion of the greenhouse effect, which is blamed for dangerous global warming, is very, very small. It's like 1 or 2 parts per hundred.
They say the
volcanoes are not a big thing, but the answer is that natural emissions are very, very big relative to industrial emissions.
They say the most dangerous volcano right now on the planet is Mount Vesuvius that blew up in 79 AD, wiped out Pompeii. 1,000 people died then.
I've seen Vesuvius,
Now they say there are 3 million people living in that area.
Oh, my.
And it's got the potential to go.
Yeah.
Next
that
up.
Would be just terrible.
Let's go to Pat in Houston, Texas. Hello, Pat.
When you started talking about the fires out west, we are in California. We've lived in Humboldt County, so we drive 101 and go through the wineries. They always had the out-of-control controlled burns that you couldn't even see right in front of you. You couldn't even drive. And the last one that they had, Pelosi had her winery, and she got reimbursed, so I thought I'd throw that in there. And then you have Humboldt County up above them, where the people in private sector would cut down the redwoods in addition to the logging, and then the toxic chemicals they used in the process, so you had pollution from that, plus the degradation of the logging and the cutting of the trees. And then that same area, you had drugs in the forest. They found Mexican cartels and the federales in there, plus the hippies, leftover hippies in the area. And you have a loss of water in California. We have that. Our water table's low in Texas, and we're getting all these people in one-third California, one-third New York, and they're flooding our border and our hospitals since last October and taking them everywhere. And then we have been building roads, and the director said we won't have enough roads in Texas even through 2045. They can't even fix what they have, and they've cut down billions of trees, just mowed them down, and it causes more flooding on top of the extraction for oil. What a mess.
It's not an easy fix, Steve, is it?
No, a lot of things going on. Sounds like tough problems that they need to solve, and I think, again, most of those are human cause and need human solutions, and not from a 1 degree rise in global temperatures in the last 140 years. That's not what is causing these problems.
Well, that's true. Well, are they fixable?
Yeah, I don't know the details of a lot of those things. I just think that forest management is the key. I even understand California. People couldn't even cut down trees on their own land or build roads through their property. They needed special permits. The environmentalists had control of many, many things. But people need to do what's proper with the forest management.
We had more carbon dioxide during the dinosaur era than we do today. Where did it all come from?
Geologists will tell us that, yes, atmospheric CO2 levels were higher in the distant past. I try not to go back that far because I don't know too much about it, but we other scientists like William Happer of Princeton, who's an advisor of mine, says that we're really in kind of a low level of atmospheric carbon dioxide right now relative to history. And so, and by the way, I hope you're I got a question for your listeners that I like to pose, and that is, what do cannabis growers know that apparently the EPA and our president doesn't know? And the answer is that carbon dioxide is plant food. Carbon dioxide
That's right.
is green.
We all knew that as kids.
Any marijuana grower worth his or her salt has a canister of carbon dioxide they're pumping into their greenhouse to make the plants and the crop grow bigger. And so there are literally hundreds of peer-reviewed studies that show all of the world's top food crops grow bigger with higher levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide, as well as pine trees. Even poison ivy grows bigger and faster. So if there's one compound we could put into the environment that is absolutely great for the biosphere, carbon dioxide is that compound. Yet today we're calling it pollution, so it's a little bit crazy.
Let's go to Walton, Pennsylvania. What's up, Walter? Go ahead.
Hi, George. I'm sorry I cut out on you last night. My cell phone, that was an automatic. My cell phone battery was low, and it cut out on me automatically.
Well, that's okay. You weren't on the air, so it didn't screw up anything.
Yeah, George, Mr. Gorham, I agree with a lot of what he's saying, but I think that neither side of the population, I mean, the climate change issue is 100% correct. I think Mr. Gorham would have to agree that it's just common sense that the human population of this planet cannot increase ad infinitum. I think we are conducting an open-ended experiment with this planet. We are using ourselves as the guinea pig. So I think it's just common sense, George. We're headed for 8 billion population. And I think, you can't have 8 billion people with their legs all wrapped around a V8 engine. So, George, I think it's just common sense.
That's a good perception. If I could go forward, there's actually good news about that. In my last book, Outside the Green Box, I wrote about the fears of overpopulation. The great news is that global population is stabilizing. Fertility rates, which is the amount of children that a woman has in her lifetime, are half what they were in the 1960s. Women are having about a little over two child per woman now, maybe a little bit higher than that. The global zero population growth is about 2.2. I think we're at about 2.5. In the 1960s, it was 5 per woman. So we're going to see global population get to be flat sometime this century. And the other good thing is that as income levels rise, people get have a better situation regardless of population. Some of the densest populated areas in the world have very high incomes, like New Jersey, for example. So the population story is actually a good story.
Absolutely. Next up, let's go to Haley in New Jersey. Welcome to the show. Hi, Haley.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Sure thing.
I just cut out at all. I'm on the road right now.
Oh, well, you drive carefully.
Thank you. I have a question. I guess for Mr. Gorham, can you just refresh me on your credentials real quick, because I may have missed it in the beginning. I'm driving, so I can't really look it up.
Well, he's not a climatologist. He is
not a scientist. No, I'm really a communicator. I'm an engineer by background. I'm a researcher. I've written 3 books on the topic, and I stand on the shoulders of other climate scientists, particularly skeptical ones, and use them as advisors. But
do you have any? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Haley.
Do you have any peer-reviewed articles written at all or published?
I do not.
Just
no,
his books.
I, I've written three books, and I've written maybe 100 articles or something that have gone into the press publication.
I'm just wondering, like, why are you so, you know, skeptical about climate change, you know, especially when there's so many experts out there, you know, saying the complete opposite of what you're saying, but how, you know, it is very much like an anthropogenic.
All right, that's fair enough. Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, that's right, because the data shows that, first off, climate has always been very uncertain. It's difficult, but if you look at the climate models have over-forecasted the actual temperature rise. That's clear if you look at data. We've only had, you know, most people think that we've had a lot of temperature rise. I had a couple young ladies from UCLA get me on a phone interview a couple years ago, and I started asking them questions, and I said to them, how much do you think global temperatures have risen since 1880? And one of the young lady students said 10 degrees. Well, the answer, though, is 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, 1 degree Celsius in 140 years. It's very, very small. A geologist will show that we've had at least four extensive periods in the last 10,000 years when it was naturally warmer than it is today. And so you got to scratch your head and say, okay, well, how can our recent warming, which has been less than the warming in the last 10,000 years in many cases, be from man-made influences? But there's much data, and you know, I encourage you to read my books with an open mind. There are 800 sources or 1,000 sources in my books. I quote the United Nations, the U.S. government, many peer-reviewed papers, many scientists. And the case seems to show that natural factors dominate global temperatures, not what your neighbor's SUV is doing.
How much of this is related to the push for money, Steve?
Yeah, money's a little bit of a factor. Let me first say that I think folks like Al Gore are sincere. Mr. Gore has always been an environmentalist. I think he believes that we're causing dangerous warming. But on the other hand, money is a big factor, and one big example are these climate models. Climate modelers, I quote in one of my books, it costs $50 million to set up a climate modeling team that runs on a supercomputer and $20 million a year to run that team on average. There are literally dozens of those teams around the world that are running these climate models. So you're talking billions of dollars just to run the climate models. So it's a very, very big factor. And by the way, you know, if you're a modeling team and you say, well, we don't think the world is heating up, and then it's tough to get money for those sorts of things. So the alarming forecasts tend to get more funding. So funding is an element, unfortunately. But, you know, the bottom line is the facts just don't support the alarm.
Steve, we're going to come back and take final calls in a moment, but would you tell folks how they can find you on your website and get your books?
Sure. My website is stevegoreham.com, G-O-R-E-H-A-M.com. And my books, Outside the Green Box and The Mad, Mad, Mad World, are available on Amazon, both ebook and softcover. Or you can get them from my website, including my original Climatism. And they're really fun reads. They have hundreds of color sidebars in them. I hired a cartoonist for each of them. Just fun to read, but still with the real science, 800 references or 1,000 references, depending on the book.
Super. We're going to come back and take final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back with final calls with Steve Gorham as we talk about climate change and get your views on it as well. Next hour, Suzanne Wilson joins us as we talk about your spirit guide, so make sure you're part of the program. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Steve Gorham. George Norrie back with you as we were talking about climate change and what's happening. And so many people have so many different views, Steve, but here's the one thing I've noticed. Some people get very angry either way on the topic. Why is that?
Yeah, it's become very emotionally charged, I guess. You know, they've done surveys of some of the younger folks as well, and a lot of there are a lot of reports of younger generations being very upset. They actually did a survey. Heartland Institute and another organization did a survey, and of I can't remember the number, but it was fairly big, a couple thousand, and 30% of them, they were asked, is there a possibility that mankind could be extinct? And 30% of them said that, yeah, within the next 100 years, because of climate change, mankind is likely to be extinct. I mean, there's some very, very big issues. We have younger folks that are saying they're not going to have children because it damages the climate. It's so it gets to be a pretty big issue, unfortunately, and very misguided, in my opinion.
Back to the calls. Rich in San Francisco, welcome to the program. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I would like to ask your guest, does he agree that there is damage to the ozone layer?
Is there damage to the ozone layer, Stephen?
Hi, Rich. I think that's kind of an open issue. There was a Montreal Protocol, I think, as you know, was set up in the late 70s. Where all the nations of the world signed up to stop emitting chlorofluorocarbons.
Out of air conditioning units and things like
that. Right, which is supposed to be going up in the atmosphere and removing or damaging ozone in the high layers of the atmosphere. And so the world got rid of those, basically. They're down more than 98% within about 15 years. There's very little of those that are being emitted now. However, we still have holes up there. I mean, the ozone holes have not gone away. NASA tracks this every year, and the reports come out in September. And so the world has stopped emitting these chlorofluorocarbons, but we still have ozone holes. My estimation is probably that these are dominated by natural factors as well, but we'll see. Now, the scientists say that the problem won't be solved until about 2040. It's going to take several more decades before we see that those ozone holes disappear. So they may be right. We'll just have to see. But so far, the measures taken have not had a big effect on the ozone holes.
Out here in California, let's go to Christine. Welcome to the show. Hi, Christine.
Yes. Hi, George. Thank you so much for your program.
I really am
enjoying your guest tonight. Thank you so much.
Sure thing. Go ahead, hon.
Yes. I wanted to ask, a couple of comments as I've been listening. I'm a nurse, and we've done ozone therapy for various viruses and diseases, and I've seen the positive effects of ozone treatments for health problems. But I wanted to specifically more and ask him about the studies that may be done on the pollution that's in our atmosphere from all the satellites. If you Google what our Earth actually looks like right now, it's surrounded by satellites. Isn't that something that is contributing to the global warming?
I don't think they are, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, Christine. That's an interesting thing. I thought you were going to talk about pollution in the atmosphere, but I think you're talking about space junk or something.
Space junk kind of like blocking sunlight or whatever.
Satellites up there. I don't think it has any effect really on the climate or on our atmosphere. It probably is a bit of a hazard up there if you have we have a bunch of people now sending private flights up there, and so they probably have to contend with the satellites. The thing is, these satellites are at different levels as well. Some are geosynchronous. They're up there about 24,000 miles up, and there are other low orbit satellites, so there's a whole bunch of them up there. I don't think they have any measurable effect on Earth's temperatures or climate, but they may have some other effects on other things. So I can't really give you a solid answer on that one.
Let's try Danny in Oklahoma City now. Welcome to the program. Hi, Danny. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, George.
Sure.
Yeah, a couple questions. Good show.
Thanks.
My first question is, like when they came out with this infrastructure bill and they talk about, I don't know if it's carbon neutral, zero emissions by the year 2050, if not sooner.
Yeah.
But yet, they say nothing about upgrading. And, you know, George is really good to hit on this often, and we're glad that he does. He stays up with not only hardening, you know, our electric grid, but upgrading it. And they say nothing about up, because if you're going to have all, if we're all going to be forced to eventually have electric cars, it looks to me like they're going to have to do a big-time upgrade on the electric grid to sustain all the charging. And I'm afraid, too, what's going to grow out of this is just, and this is the dark side that they don't talk about as well, is what will grow out of it is more and more oppression on people. Like, well, you can only charge your car on odd days, kind of like, you know, watering during a drought season and odd days.
Yeah.
And so they don't talk about upgrading the grid to keep up with the load that's going to be required to keep all these cars charged up. And I'm sure these batteries, too, create some kind of a pollution, don't they?
Danny, that's some interesting comments. Yeah, there's some big issues with the whole transition to net zero. First, in short, there are no net zero processes that don't emit. If you build a house and you put glass in it and you put brick in it and you put drywall in it and you put piping and electrical work, everything you put in that house is manufactured and emits carbon dioxide when it occurs. Matter of fact, if somebody builds a grass hut, it emits carbon dioxide. They cut down the trees, CO2 is emitted. So this net zero emission stuff is very hocus pocus. They're talking about lower emissions, not zero. There is no zero, and they want to go plant a bunch of trees. But you're right. The big problem with what's going on in the grid isn't necessarily that we're going to add electric vehicles. If those are the best cars, then that would be okay. The problem is that they want to force us to get rid of all the natural gas, all the coal, and run everything on wind and solar, basically. And that is going to be very, very difficult. And you're right. One of the drawbacks, not only the intermittency thing, but one of the drawbacks is waste.
That's right.
We're about to enter what I call the age of renewable waste. These wind turbine blades wear out, and if you've seen some pictures, you try and put those in a landfill, and they just fill up the whole landfill. They're shipping them now from Iowa into Nebraska because the landfills in Iowa won't take them. But people have estimated if we really get to this net zero and put up all these wind turbines, we're going to create as much wind turbine waste as total global plastic waste annually by the year 2050, and the amount of solar panel waste is likely to be as big as total global plastic waste. There's some big, big issues. Batteries are another one. To produce all these electric cars require batteries, and it's going to require a tremendous amount of mining. My sister had said to me, well, I like renewables because I don't like mining. Well, that's the exact opposite for batteries. You got to get lithium and copper and cobalt and a whole bunch of things for every 1,000-pound battery, and that's about what is required in an EV for it to get any range. You got to move 500,000 pounds of earth, and so if EVs take over the world, you're going to need to increase global mining by factors of 5 and 10, not 5 or 10%, but 5 or 10 times as much to power those vehicles. And that's part of the reason I think that they're not going to penetrate as much as we think they are. So some good comments and observations you have.
Let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Gina's with us now. Hello, Gina.
Hi, it's Dana.
It's what?
George. It's Dana, D-A-N-A.
Dana. Oh, okay. All right.
Hi, Dana.
Hi, George. George, hi. Hi, Stephen. I would like to thank both of you. First, George, I would like to thank you for asking Stephen about the homes being built by water, that it isn't climate change. In fact, if anyone does the research, it's quite easy to find. Homes were not allowed to be built where they're being built now and in the past decade. and because insurance companies wouldn't insure them.
That's right.
So the government, like they always do, stepped in and said, oh, we'll pay for it. But really, the government doesn't pay for anything. You and I, through our tax dollars, pay when a hurricane comes through. So we're paying for them to live on prime real estate. The other thing I'd like to thank you for addressing, George, is the money. The grants is what, and Stephen answered that, that the grants is what's funding this. So if you don't toll the grant, the climate change line and do the agree with this redistribution of wealth that Stephen addressed, then you're going to get cut off. So the woman who called and asked Stephen what his credentials were and if his stuff was peer-reviewed, the people that are doing the peer reviews, the scientists as well as university professors that are peer-reviewing articles are the very people that are totally surviving off grants. This stuff is not hard to find, including the data that Stephen mentioned, that the data does not back up what they're feeding us. And if that woman that called in does any research, Stephen talked about the redistribution through the UN of from wealthy countries. Ban Ki-moon was the head of the UN several years back under Obama. He's the one who really pushed all this and really started this. And he's neither a meteorologist, scientist, climatologist. He just started all of this, and it was for the purpose of redistribution. So to my question, Stephen, could you please address, I missed the very first little bit of the show, could you address how incredible it is when we have global warming? Because many famines wiped out European populations because they couldn't grow any crops. Britain and the continent, continental Europe, they resorted to even, things as cannibalism, killing children, infanticide, because there was nothing to eat. And then came these great warming periods and crops grew, and hence people flourished. They were healthier and they lived longer, on and on and on. Can you please address that, Stephen, how good warmth is for the world?
Well, I think warming temperatures do provide an agricultural benefit, particularly in the northern climates. You get longer growing seasons. The second thing is that carbon dioxide is a natural fertilizer, and so the atmospheric carbon dioxide has been rising for at least the last 100 years or so, either from natural causes and some from our industry, and so that helps our crops grow as well. But probably the biggest factor is the miracle of modern agriculture. Farmers can grow so much nowadays. Just to give you an example, the U.S. agricultural land for corn peaked in 1918, yet today we grow about 10 times as much corn as we did in 1918. And, of course, those are all from all the modern agricultural techniques. And so modern agriculture is a miracle. The food we eat is a miracle, and we had many, many people thought the world was going to run out of food, like a Paul Ehrlich, a population bomb,
mm-hmm.
But instead, farmers have been able to produce so much food that the world is better fed now than it has been, and it's going to be better and better as we go through the century. So really a lot of optimistic progress along those lines, but the climate is a small part of that.
Stephen, we are out of time. Keep in touch with us. Let us know when your next project pops up, okay?
Thank you so much, George. Always a pleasure to join you.
You take care of yourself. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, Suzanne Wilson joins us. We're going to be talking about spirit guides, mediumship, intuition, and all those great little paranormal things in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.